This is episode 234 of the 200 Churches Podcast.
We're so frightened by God. We spend most of our lives trying to domesticate our worship of God. And what I try to do is help people rediscover the oddness of the everyday worship of God in a way that we are able to recover in what way God is very frightening, yet makes life worth living.
Welcome to the 200 Churches Podcast, where every Wednesday we produce a fresh episode of ministry encouragement for pastors of small churches. Now here are two guys who, like you, serve in the trenches of small church ministry. The Amos and Andy of Ministry Podcasts, Jeff and Johnny.
This is the 200 Churches Podcast. My name is Jeff Cady, and I'm here with my good friend and podcast partner,
Johnny Craig. Why did you point at me when you said that, like you were cueing me to come in?
I don't know. I was just holding my pen.
230 episodes in, you're still telling me I need to come in.
But I never do that.
No, you don't.
This is, what is this, episode, what, 234?
Oh, my goodness. How did we ever get here?
Well, I'll tell you how we got here. We just had a 42-minute conversation with Dr. Stanley Hauerwas.
Oh, my goodness.
That's how we got to this moment in time. We decided we're going to record the intro and outro right now. Well, his words are fresh in our ears.
When I was in seminary, and it was probably even in college, someone gave me some Hauerwas, just an article.
Does it go on your sausage? Or
and yes, to put all over my sausage. And it was revolutionary. If you're not reading Stanley Hauerwas, you're doing yourself a disservice. And then some in college, I had to read his book, Resident Aliens, which we talk about here a little bit at the end of this episode. And it blew my mind. It blew my mind. And he's just an incredible, incredible theologian and someone I never believed I would talk to. And yet here now I have his phone number, and maybe I'll just send him a text once in a while like, yo, what up, Stan?
Yeah, probably not.
No, probably not.
So honestly, we have to warn you, pastors. We have to warn you. You have to be ready to just sit at the feet of an author, a scholar, a thinker, a professor,
yeah,
who doesn't really care what I think or what Johnny thinks or what you think.
Well, and he's retired from,
As Johnny says, you know, we read stuff in books written by authors, theologians, scholars, and certain things we wouldn't necessarily want to say right out on a Sunday morning.
Right.
But we've realized that when you get these men and women on your podcast,
They say it.
And so then it's coming out to you. So I don't know what kind of I don't want to give this episode a disclaimer other than I want, and Johnny, we both want our podcast to encourage and inspire, but also to educate.
Yes.
Right? So that we can think new thoughts. We may not agree with those thoughts, because I don't agree with everything all of our guests say.
Right.
But I want to hear from people, and honestly, I want to hear from people that disagree with me, or that I disagree with, to sharpen my own thinking,
yeah,
and to help me learn and grow.
So that's the thing. We spend a lot of this conversation, unexpectedly on my part, talking about Eucharist or communion or the Lord's Supper, however you talk about it in your church. And it's very clear that Dr. Hauerwas has a particular theological view of Eucharist, and that's great. That's wonderful. But we always say we're not here to debate theology. What I would say is if your theology of the table differs from his theology, you still have something to learn from his view. You don't have to adopt the theology behind it, I don't think, to really lean into what he says it means and what happens when we come together around the table. Does that make sense? So when you listen to this, you don't have to adopt every view that Stanley Hauerwas has. I get him to disagree with somebody else on this podcast, and they're both titans, you know, of thinking,
right,
and yet, you know, they have a disagreement. We don't ask you to agree with everything. We ask you to listen and be challenged by everything that Dr. Hauerwas says.
Well, when he talks about the Eucharistic celebration,
yeah,
every Sunday morning,
right,
that is on par with the preaching, and that seals the words of the message.
It's challenging,
right? It forces me to say, what in the world am I thinking?
right.
When I stand behind the communion table on a Sunday morning,
yeah,
and I talk to our people about what we're about to share,
yeah,
I feel pretty weak-kneed right now, you know, thinking about what I do. And again, not that we're going to adopt 100% his methods, but boy, it really makes you think about what Jesus meant when he said, do this in remembrance of me.
And then being shaped for mission by, yes, by that gather. So these are challenging thoughts. That's how I would say it. And he says things that will make you sit back and say, whoa, he said that. Yeah, he said that. And he's Stanley Hauerwas, so he says what he wants. But we just felt honored that we got to have that conversation and that we get to bring it to you. Because this is high-level stuff, you know? And he's retired. You can't even go get into Duke and take his class anymore, you know? It's he's follow him around his lecture series maybe. But we feel really grateful for Dr. Hauerwas hanging out with us and talking to us, and we are so glad to be able to give you something to chew on and work through today. We are so glad to be joined today by Dr. Stanley Hauerwas. You know, when we started this podcast, I never thought that I would be able to talk to people whose books that I read and who had made such a difference in my faith journey. And then I picked up your email from a mutual friend, and you emailed me back and signed it Stan, and now I feel like we're friends. So can you introduce yourself a little bit for us today?
I'm retired. I taught for 2 years at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, then 14 years at Notre Dame, and the rest of the time at the Divinity School at Duke. I was raised a bricklayer. My father took me out on the job when I was 7. And I learned all the skills of being a laborer until I finally was allowed to start laying brick when I was around 15 or 16. I went to Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas, and then on to Yale Divinity School and Yale Graduate School. I say not all Christians need to become theologians in order to be a Christian, but I probably did. I became a theologian because I couldn't get saved. I was raised in an evangelical Methodist church in which you could join the church and be baptized on Sunday morning, but you had to be saved on Sunday night for it to really indicate that it sure. had taken. I was about 14 or 15, and I'd started to date, so I was sinning. And I thought, well, I want to be saved, but I didn't think you should fake it. So I one night we were singing I Surrender All for the 33rd time for the altar call, and I thought this is going to go on all night. So I went up to the altar and dedicated my life to the Lord, not having any idea what that might mean. I started to read because the associate minister told me, he had been to seminary, told me that you're supposed to read. And I read a lot of very bad books, but then I read a book by B. David Napier called From Faith to Faith, and I discovered that the Bible wasn't true. We weren't fundamentalists, but we thought the Bible was true. I read Nels F. S. Farré's The Sun and the Umbrella. That was a takeoff on Plato's cave that suggested that religion probably hid God more than revealed God, and so I thought that's probably right, so I gave it up. But I was... no one in my family had ever gone to college, so I decided that I had to go to college because I told my mother and father that I was going, I dedicated my life to the Lord, and they didn't know I had these doubts. So I went to college, and I thought, I was the philosophy major at Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas, and I had a great education there, and I thought, I slowly began to think that I wasn't smart enough to be an atheist, and so I decided to go to divinity school to find out if the stuff was true. But I thought if I were a Christian, I'd be a liberal Christian, a Kilikian. But I'd become increasingly convinced that the destruction of the Jews was the strongest reason not to be Christian. And I was stunned to discover that the liberals, of course, had given the Jews up, and it was Karl Barth and Bonhoeffer that stood against it. And so I became a reader of Barth and the rest of history. That's what I've been trying to work out ever since.
Wow.
Now, did I see that you also taught at Duke Law School as well?
I have an appointment. I had an appointment at Duke Law School. I actually taught more directly in the law at Notre Dame, but law students would come over and take my courses.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. And what kind of a course would a law student take if you're teaching religion? Well, not religion, of course, because you gave that up.
A course that I would be teaching, like on Aristotle and Aquinas or Kant and Barth, a course on practical reason, so on.
Okay.
Very cool. Very cool. So we want to talk to you today about the church. And I think that you stand apart from a lot of people who comment on culture and religion, in that from what I've read of you and my understanding is you have some hope and faith in the church. Would you say that's a fair thing to say?
Absolutely. My way of putting it is, no Israel, no Jesus, no church, no Jesus. And so I believe strongly that we only come to know Christ through witness, and the witness, the name of the witness is church, through which you discover that out of all the peoples in the world, God called Israel to be his promised people, and that isn't a truth that you know separate from a people. And the church is the people that have been engrafted into that promise. And the same holds. The way you know that is by being part of that people. I can put it very aggressively and say, without that, outside the church, there's no salvation. Probably it's put more accurately, without the church, there's no salvation. So I'm a great critic of the presumption that I have a relationship with God that I go to church to have expressed. You don't know what God it is you have a relationship with without first going to church.
So when you're talking, when you're using the word church right there, what, how would you define that word, as you're saying it's necessary for the gospel, it's necessary to know God, etc.?
I don't define anything, because definitions inherently are misleading. But I will describe the church as the gathered people of God to worship God, because you know God through worship, and that is done among a baptized people who have been made part of the death and resurrection of Christ. And that baptism leads that people to share in the body and blood through Eucharistic celebration. That's how you know who it is you're worshiping.
So we have faith in the church. We believe in the church, the importance of the church. You know, you're saying even that people can't know God outside of the church, right? In so
right.
many ways. And yet,
I mean,
okay, go ahead.
It doesn't mean that there are not people who God has called out, who we recognize, and they come to recognize the God who's called them out. But without the church, there would be no way to know how that recognition works, because God is not some generalized name for a holder of something that had to start it all. I mean, God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Are coming up to Trinity Sunday. It's crucial designation to know God as the Father, because Jesus was the Son, having made known through the work of the Holy Spirit.
So we have faith in the church, and we believe in the church, and yet you sometimes are a critic of the church in North America. Do you think that's a fair thing to say?
Of course. I deeply distrust a great deal of what passes for Christianity and church Christianity in America. I think that one of the great problems of American Christianity has been the confusion between the American we and the Christian we. The Christian we is a Catholic we, insofar as we are connected with Christians in Nicaragua and the Congo more determinedly than we are connected with other Americans.
So that's a big idea now for some of our listeners, I'm sure, because patriotism is next to godliness, and a national identity is, you know, a valuable and important part of our lives, right? And you're seeming to suggest that maybe that can get in the way of our authentic faith?
Of course it gets in the way. And it's not only gets in the way, there's a name for it. It's called idolatry. I wrote a little piece about Trump's inauguration, in which he said that it was a day set aside for patriotic devotion. Well, devotion is owed to God. You don't owe it to a nation. And indeed, you want to make sure that a nation is not the subject of devotion. Hmm. And then in the speech, I think the phrase was, he suggested that he wanted unconditioned loyalty. Again, that can only be given to God, not the nation.
Well, we're talking about definitions. You know, we don't want to make definitions here. Dr. H, in America today, we're talking primarily to small church pastors. What are some things that they should think about as they pastor their flock of, you know, 50 or 100 people who really need direction, who need leadership, who need biblical, theological guidance? What are some of the key things that you believe pastors should be thinking of in light of the culture that we live in?
Well, how to help people recognize that the American flag should not be in the chancel of the church. The sacrifice of the altar is the only sacrifice that we recognize as the one that determines all other sacrifices. The American flag in the chancel is simply it usually is there from World War I and World War II, symbolizing, quote, the sacrifices of American servicemen in defense of liberty and so on. I don't in any way mean to demean that their lives, but it is a distraction from the sacrifice of the altar. Of course, that means that they should help school their people for why it is that Eucharistic sacrifice is so important to be done every Sunday, and how to help people discover that as part of the life of the church in a way that doesn't make the sermon the central act, I think is part of what small church pastors need to help people discover, because what they learn from God showing up as the body and blood of Christ is that this is serious business in a way that Christians simply do not get up from the altar to pick up a gun to kill someone. So those are very basic habits that I think small church, large church people need to recover.
So if we're talking about being a church that's shaped for mission, which is something that you're going to be talking about soon at Northern Seminary, and I would tell everybody who's close to Chicago to find their way to that. That's put on by our friends David Fitch and Jeff Holzclaw and a consortium of people there. If we're going to be shaped to be a people on mission, are you saying we start with the Eucharist?
Absolutely. That's what are you a mission for if you aren't calling people into a body that otherwise would not exist? If you think that mission is simply church growth, then I think you are going to cheat the gospel. The church isn't on a mission the church is a mission. And just to the extent that mission becomes a way to talk about evangelism as increasing membership, you lose what it means for the church to be mission.
So for pastors that are listeners who are non-liturgical, you know, evangelical, when you say Eucharistic celebration, you are speaking of a recognition of the body and partaking of the elements of communion. And
right.
And that time, you said, you believe, at least in every service, should be paramount and set apart, so even above the primacy of the preaching time.
Well, I don't want to say above. I think that the word, and as Calvin put it, the word must be sealed by the Eucharist. And that means that the effective word is to be seen through Eucharistic celebration in a way that word and sacrament cannot be separated.
So I'm wrapping my head around this idea, and I think I got to wrap my head around it because a lot of churches, a lot of church traditions in America, we've devalued the table. I mean, we've devalued Eucharistic celebration. Can you walk us through, you know, why that's happened and how to regain it?
Well, I think it happened because of the evangelical revivalistic character of a good deal of American Christianity. When I grew up, you had to be saved in a tent, right?
With sawdust. Sawdust.
Yes, right, right. And that was hymn singing for an hour, testimonials for another hour, and then the evangelist call to be saved for an hour. And that was worship. The idea that you had a common life as embodied in Eucharist simply didn't exist. And the tent became the paradigm for how worship was understood. And that meant usually that the high point of worship was a white guy in their 50s providing a charismatic sermon that then people could leave and say, boy, that was really dramatic, and then not be able to remember what was said, you know, a day later. And that became, I think, the standard for so much of American Christianity. People would say, oh, you know, you don't want to have usually the language of communion every Sunday because that would just make it stale. And it's so special, we just want to do it every once in a while. I always say when people give me that kind of argument, I say, yeah, I think we ought to quit saying the Lord's Prayer every Sunday. I mean, it makes it stale and so on. Obviously, worship involves a good deal of repetition. And the repetition is necessary for us to get it.
When you say that, you remind me of the critics who talk about the 7-11 songs, you know, 7 words, 11 times. And I think that principle is whatever people enjoy those kinds of songs, they get that from it. They get that repetition. It takes so many times, and after they sing it the 4th or 5th or 6th or 10th time, all of a sudden they realize what they're singing. And they're like, oh, yeah, this is true. This is important to me. So you're saying in the worship service, to have communion every week, to have the Eucharist every week, that it unites people. And I forget that you used a term there. People come together and they unite around the Eucharist. Maybe just tease that out a little bit. How does that observance and how does that ritual unite them?
First of all, they're united through baptism and to the death and resurrection of Christ. Only the baptized receive, because they are the body that have become Christ for the world in a way that makes possible an alternative to the world's violence. And that is, quote, the mission, to be an alternative to the world so that the world might know that God has not abandoned us. Now, that means that fundamental duality is not between nature and grace and so on. The fundamental duality is between church and world. And the world cannot know it is the world unless there's a church that is the alternative. So the action that God enacts in Eucharistic celebration is how the church becomes an alternative to the world, because you don't become part of God without that making a difference for how the world is understood.
So in that action that God enacts through that Eucharistic celebration, in that, are you observing that there is sacrifice, the sacrifice of Christ, who then says for us to be like him and to sacrifice for others, and it calls us to be different and to be like him?
That's right.
So if we start at the table to be living the mission of the church, what else is there? I mean, where do we go from the table? What does that look like to be a church that is living its mission?
Well, if you take the prayer that ends the Eucharistic liturgy in the Book of Common Prayer, the prayer is, Eternal God, Heavenly Father, you have graciously accepted us as living members of your Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ. And you have fed us with spiritual food in the sacrament of his body and blood. Send us now into the world in peace, and grant us strength and courage to love and serve you with gladness and singleness of heart through Christ our Lord. Send us now into the world in peace. I don't think people that pray that prayer could think that you want a Donald Trump to make you safe. Jesus makes you safe, and that safety will include a lot of danger, because you're now sent into the world in peace and granted strength and courage to love and serve you. I mean, that's a whole way of life that certainly indicates a strong difference.
We're bringing the pieces together now, where you've talked about our identity as the church being separate from our identity as part of whatever nation we're from. And people who listen to this podcast, we got, you know, Americans, obviously, but people in Australia, Canada, Brazil, 30 countries.
Good.
That's, you know, that's for every country, not just us here in America. Mm-hmm. And
right.
Now you're bringing this other piece to it and saying, this is how we're shaped and become. And when you go out into the world with those words and with that mission, you almost can no longer help but be broken off from your nationalistic self, right?
That's true. Right. That's right. And, of course, that means that you may well turn up not to be trusted by your other neighbors who are not Christians.
Because with them, they would think our primary relationship with each other is our shared, you know, heritage, whatever that might be.
Right. Right.
So this is the cost then, yeah? And now we're talking, you know, way back in 1980, whatever, you wrote Resident Aliens, and these are some of those ideas.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's interesting. When Will and I wrote that book, the original title was The Colony from Philippians. And I didn't like that very, very well. And my wife was reading through the manuscript, and she found that phrase, resident alien. She said, why don't you call it resident alien? And I said, oh, that's great. So Will said, Will liked it too. And so we sent the manuscript to Abingdon and said, you know, we'd like you to consider it. And they said, well, we really like the book, but we don't like the title. And we said, oh, really? Why? And they said, well, we're afraid people will think it's about Mexicans crossing the border. We said, perfect. That's what we want.
So when you're critiquing this, for instance, you use Donald Trump's name, okay? And It doesn't sound like you're so much critiquing him because that would be, you know, fodder for another discussion. Mm-hmm. But you're really talking about how believers view themselves in their culture, his country or any other country.
Right.
Correct? And
that's right.
And that, you know, we have one king, his name is Jesus, and no matter what country we're in, we have to follow and obey him. And perhaps weekly observance of the Eucharist helps us to focus more on that.
Well, I don't want to make the Eucharist instrumental to having some result, because if the word is properly said, then there's nothing you can do to stop God from showing up. And that's a very frightening business, because what is crucial is that this really is the transformation of a people into the body of Christ. And that means that that makes everything else that we are intelligible. And everything else that we are will be dependent on the narrative of what it means to be a disciple of Christ.
So we talked to Walter Brueggemann a couple weeks ago, and our listeners will get to hear Walter Brueggemann a few weeks after this episode airs. So we're setting you guys up, you know, kind of in a row like that. And he talks about, here's a preview for everybody. He talks about the twofold mission of the church: to be a testimony, a counter testimony to the ways of the empire, and then also to lobby the government to act in ways that are more economically helpful, right? The economics of neighborliness, and to make overtures toward the government and to lobby the government to act that way. I would imagine you wouldn't see it quite in the same lens, but help me out.
Well, the first is certainly Walter and I are in complete agreement.
Yeah.
Part of the problem of the second is Christians think that what it means to have a social witness is to be the left wing of the Democratic Party. Well, first of all, there is no left wing of the Democratic Party left. secondly, to focus on state policies can be quite narrowing for the kind of vision Christians should have about how we are political. I mean, I want to start with just very basic stuff. Some years ago, I was speaking at a school who had started a business school, and they wanted it to be ethical. So they had endowed a lectureship in ethics. And at the dinner before, the assistant dean of the school had told me she was a member of a church that grew between 50 and 100 every Sunday. And I gave the lecture. It's called "My Business Ethics is a Bad Idea," and I was critiquing quandary ethics and so on. And when I finished, she said, "This sounds so cynical. Isn't there something we can do?" And I said, "There is, but I think it's too late to start a business school. They're already too corrupt by that time." I said, "I think before you let anyone join the church that you go to, you ought to have them turn around to the congregation and say what they make in public. I make $85,000 a year. I want to be a member of this church. I make 100, or I make 35, and so on." And she said, "We couldn't do that." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, all that's private." I said, "You know, where are the fundamentalists when you need them? I mean, God knocked off Ananias and Sapphira for not being willing to share what they'd made on the sale of their property. Where did all this privacy stuff come from?" So I'm quite fascinated about what it might mean for the church to focus itself on itself in a way to develop the imaginative care of one another through challenging some of the commonplaces that determine our lives.
That's pretty radical stuff.
Have you read the New Testament lately?
I think Walter said the same thing when we told him he sounded radical.
Yeah, he just said,
"Well, go read the Bible."
Yeah. So when this comes out, actually, Dr. Howard Watts, when this comes out, it will be a month after your time at Northern Seminary. So you're going to go and you're going to talk about does the world still need the church? Or is the church still relevant to the world? Or some variation of that. Just give us the three-minute cliff notes. What do you want the people at that lectureship to walk away with when you're done speaking?
I'll do it in a more economical way than 3 minutes.
Okay.
I want them to think, by God, Christianity's interesting. It's interesting. It's a way of life that I thought I'd gotten used to and therefore had lost what an extraordinary adventure it is.
I get the sense in talking to you that you have a great love for small churches, and maybe the larger a church, maybe the more distrustful you're going to be. So you're talking to small church pastors now. What would you say to them? What word of encouragement would you give?
Know how to speak the truth to the people you've come to love, and that's a very difficult business, to know how to tell people that you love the truth, because we know as we come to love people, and as they come to love us, that often there is suffering that is not generally known, and that makes us back off from saying what we know to be true. Therefore, to be the clergy in a small church, you can not serve people well exactly because you try to back off from making the truth known to them. And part of the truth is their own failures and their own shortcomings. And that is an ongoing task of love shaped by truth. But a love that isn't shaped by truth is accursed, and that is the ongoing challenge, I think, of the ministry in any size church, but it comes particularly intense in small churches.
That's very interesting. We understand what you're saying, believe me. I do want to back up to the thing you said just before this. You said that people have gotten used to Christianity as a way of life, and they've lost the adventure that it actually is. And that's something that you want the people to walk away from after your lectures at Northern Seminary. Do you want to just unpack that for another economic moment?
We're so frightened by God. We spend most of our lives trying to domesticate our worship of God. And what I try to do is help people rediscover the oddness of the everyday worship of God in a way that we forget that God, that in a way that we are able to recover in what way God is very frightening yet makes life worth living.
I do hear a lot of Bart in everything that you've said here. I can see that
That's
he's
right.
had an influence, yeah.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed talking with you guys.
We appreciate your time, Dr. Hawass.
Very, very awesome.
Very much so. And we'll send you a little notice when this goes out, and you can just say, oh, good, it went out, and then get on with your day.
That's what I would say.
That's right. Hey, thanks so much for sharing this time with us.
Certainly. You take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now you know what we meant. when we said, you know, you just got to listen and work through it.
Yeah.
This was not an exercise in entertainment delivery.
No.
That's for sure. But it was an exercise in content management.
Oh, man.
Because Johnny and I were trying to manage Howard Wass's content in our minds. It wasn't working all that great.
There was moments where we were looking at each other like, what? We got to keep up with this guy's talking about, man.
We knew he was getting somewhere.
Sure.
And we were trying to figure it out at times. But, you know, this guy, it just comes from a scholar's mind.
Right.
And from a very fertile mind in the scriptures and in theology.
So we ran out of time at the end with him. I was going to ask him to tell this story. So he ended by telling pastors to tell the truth, right? And that was the hard thing for small church pastors to do, was to be truthful with people. And
can you hold that thought for a second?
Yeah.
That he said that. He also said something else. When I asked him, what does he think is so important for pastors to know? He said, get the flag out of the church.
Yeah.
That was like the first thing he said.
That was wild.
Right? It was wild because it would be wildly controversial with a lot of you listeners for various reasons. And I hope that you heard him out. But what was he really saying in saying that? He was saying, who do we worship? Who do we trust?
Right.
Whose sacrifice is paramount in the church? Not to downplay anyone else's sacrifice.
Right. He was specific about that.
But there is only one sacrifice, right? In the church, in the gathering of the believers. And it was almost as if he was saying, in any country where you're in and you're listening to this, if you have the flag of your country,
get that Brazilian flag down, Pedro.
You know, hey, that's right, Pedro. In alongside the altar of sacrifice of the Lord Jesus Christ, it doesn't belong there.
Right.
So pure-hearted, single-minded devotion to Jesus Christ as Lord is where you start in the even the small church.
I would say that he's suggesting, hey, pastor, tell the truth. Tell the truth even in your sanctuary about what you're there for and what you're about. And that would be a truth-telling endeavor then, I would say, to remove a national flag.
Could also be an unemployment line endeavor.
So this is the story that he tells is at the beginning of this, he talks about his own personal story and he starts with bricklaying, which is incredible if you think
right,
about
it. Right.
You know, this is he told this like biography, which was really incredible. It's not what I expected. And he talks about bricklaying. I actually, I have a friend, somebody who comes to our church, and he went to Duke Divinity, took a class with Dr. Hauerwas, and he's heard Dr. Hauerwas tell the story of keeping the trowel and bucket from his bricklaying days in his office. And it reminds him to tell the truth because he knows that there's something else he could go do, right? If the truth got him fired. Think about that. It reminds him to be truthful, to be honest, because he doesn't want to be so dependent on an institution for a job that he loses the ability to tell the truth. So for our bivocational pastors, you're already there. Hey, good for you.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, for our other pastors, will we have the courage to tell the truth?
What would we have, little brown UPS trucks on ourselves? did you ever get one of those?
We could go back.
I actually got one of those.
You must have been there longer than me.
I don't know what I did with it. I think I gave it to my boys and they broke it.
That sounds about right. That's what would have happened.
You know, that's really interesting. You know, and pastor, you know this is true. Don't we always play within the tension of what do we say and what don't we say?
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, we could tell the truth and blow things up, but how you tell the truth is something else that we didn't really talk about with him. But maybe the truth can't be delivered in one segment because it couldn't be digested in one meal. So the truth has to be delivered in multiple segments over a time span that is digestible for your people. So that's shepherding and that's wisdom.
I will say we should never on a podcast say, oh, our guest said something and maybe overstated it. But there's a pastoral management of change that has to stand alongside the things that Dr. Hauerwas talked about. You know, he's talking black and white today, tomorrow.
Right.
And
right.
We know, and I think he knows, that there's pastoral management that happens. I was just discussing with somebody today. I said, if you could make a change in your church over a 3-year period that would result in 90% of people staying, or a 3-month period that would result in 60% of people staying, which do you think is a more God-honoring way to do it? It was the 3-year period, you know what I mean? And so we know as pastors that we need to be moving people in those directions. Telling the truth, yes. Telling the truth in love, yes. And that's a great word for us today.
And this podcast episode is a movement that I think is moving us as pastors, small church pastors, large church, whatever size church you're in. This kind of an episode just moves us a little further down the road of growth and learning.
Absolutely.
And if you only ever hear the stuff that you agree with and or understand completely, you're not listening to the right stuff and you're not reading the right stuff.
Absolutely right.
So this is just a piece of the pie.
Maybe someday we can get Dr. Hauerwas back to shock us some more. And this time we'll make him talk on Skype for better audio quality, but we're grateful for him and for his time, and we can't wait to show up with a new episode for you next week here on the 200 Churches Podcast.
We hope you've been encouraged and inspired by this episode of the 200 Churches Podcast. If you haven't already, subscribe at 200churches.com and receive the guy's free PDF download called Our 7 Favorite Ministry Resources. You can count on us to be back next Wednesday with another brand new shiny episode just for you. Until then, may God bless you as you lead and love the people in your 200 church.
I'm ready.
You're always ready, aren't you? That's what I think.
Do you have any questions before we start?
No.
Okay.
I liked what he said about telling the truth. That was really good.
Yes, let's unpack this. So this is July the 12th, and okay. It is episode 234.
Okay.
Do I say the even ones?
I say the even ones.
Okay,
and
so
then
I'll
you
start
it. It's still recording.
Okay. Oh. Yay. Man. I'm going to keep it on here. Okay. I'll just keep it all in one.
Okay. That's good.
Now you know what we meant when